Hello, friends. This is Steve, and happy Friday. Welcome to the Friday Conversation, episode 109. This week, I wanted to have a candid conversation about content creation, and who better to have on than Matt, who's had a YouTube channel for a relatively short period of time, and he's experienced a ton of success. We did plan this before the time change, before daylight savings time, so there was a little bit of a mix-up there. So I apologize as everyone trickles in as we realize that I goofed. So heads up for that. Hope you enjoy the episode. Had a really great time. And if you'd like to find more of me, I can also be found on Page Chewing Comics and Manga, where I have a Pick of the Week episode every week with Mike, my co-host, about the books we pick up. And we also discuss various graphic novels there on that podcast, and also Film Chewing, where we discuss a movie just about every other week called the Saturday Cinephile, or Cinephile Saturday, either way. Come by and check those out. And in the meantime, hope you have a great week and hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks so much for listening. Hello, friends. My name is Steve, and welcome back to the Friday Conversation. The goal of this one was to talk content creation, and who better to ask about content creation than Matt and Chris? So Chris, will you start us off with an introduction?
Yeah, those that can't see us doing each other, saying he's talking about me, isn't he? Knowing that he obviously wasn't talking about me. Yes, my name is Chris Moon. Sometimes make YouTube videos, sometimes appear on other people's channels talking about interesting topics, just like this one. Yeah, that's about it.
Awesome. And Matt.
Hey, this is Matt. I have a YouTube channel called Matt's Fantasy Book Reviews, where I primarily specialize in, I know it's a big surprise, but book reviews, fantasy book reviews. But I do like some sci-fi and some other stuff too, but you know, 90%, 95% fantasy, and then some other random videos when I have the inspiration or free time. But yeah, and have my channel for a couple of years and happy to be on.
Nice. Good. Great to have you. Thank you for making time for us. We know you're very busy.
Of course.
And PL just popped in. Hey, PL.
Hey everyone, how's it going? Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Yeah, we'll be talking content creation. I wanted to have an author's viewpoint on this too, like kind of what, you know, how it works, kind of the whole circle of content and reviews and things like that. But so Matt, I was curious about your channel, because your channel's fairly new, but you have like tens of thousands of subs. Did you have a plan when you started your channel?
No, I started my channel because I had, I'd made a lot of reviews on Goodreads and was, you know, trying to pump out a lot of reviews kind of historically for the books that I've read. And because of the way Goodreads works, it picks you up because of the number of likes you get, because I was just pumping out reviews of old books. And so I kind of had a bigger following over there randomly without kind of trying it. And it just, as I saw people like Patrick and other people that kind of did similar stuff, and I kept seeing his reviews being above mine on the rankings, I was like, hey, this sounds fun. And so I just got like an early review of like a John Gwen book. And I was like, hey, this would be a cool first video, because I'll be like the first person with a review of it. So I just turned on a video and just started doing it.
And since that first video, did you have kind of a plan to roll out certain types of content, or did you just kind of do whatever you felt would work? Or do you choose the type of content by kind of what will be the most engagement, or do you do what you would enjoy the most?
Yeah, I mean, so I started out doing simply book reviews, just real simple, turn the camera on as I'm finishing the book, talk about the book for like 10, 15 minutes. Don't ever take takes, turn it off and upload it. And so I did that for quite a while. And then every now and then I would just have some spare time and decide to do like a top 10 video or something. And then just kind of decided to do that formula. So my formula is essentially review every book that I read, no matter what I thought about it. And then if I have extra time, do something more fun, you know, random stuff, not have to care about doing it on a consistent schedule.
I think it's so interesting, Matt, because like if you speak to most content creators, especially in BookTube, they'll tell you the book reviews are the absolute death of all engagement, you know, in terms of doing it. But you have, I want to say corner of the market. No, I just think do it very well in terms of creating both book reviews that people can engage with, regardless of whether they read the book or not, or at least even get what they want out of, you know, whether they want short form, because you put the ratings, et cetera, on your thumbnails, et cetera, which I think is actually an interesting way to do it, rather than being a surprise about halfway through the video where you go, I actually hated the book, or otherwise you can kind of get what you know going in. And actually that is a very different approach than I think that many others take to doing it, even certainly myself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why it's not been the death of my channel. I can't really explain it. I can say that when you do the more cliche top 10 best books, when you look at the stats for those kind of videos, you're going to undoubtedly get more subscribers and views on those kind of things. But as I make the reviews, I find that those reviews actually, they do have a short-term disappointment, I think, if you care. I don't care. This isn't my life. I do this for fun, and I don't put effort into my videos. Maybe that's what people like about them, but I don't spend time making videos. I literally hit record and then I throw on a little quick graphic, and the whole process from hitting record on my camera to having the video uploaded to YouTube is like 30 minutes. So I just don't care about that kind of thing. But if I did, I see people like friends of mine, they go away from doing the reviews because you look at them and it's like, oh, I got, you know, 1,000 views and like 4 subscribers. But then go look at it like 2 years later, and you have thousands of views and 50 subscribers, because those things have lasting value. People will always read a book. People eventually, the algorithm will no longer suggest your top 10 video you made. No one will ever watch it again over time, but they will click on your random book you did as some random sci-fi book forever, because people will constantly read it and want to look up things about it. So I think if you look at the long-term approach, book reviews can be really cool for growth if you stick to them. You just got to ignore the short term and the medium term.
And I think part of why your reviews are so popular and why you do so well with them is because you're honest. You don't pull any punches. And I think people appreciate that.
Yeah. It's all I know really how to do. I thought when I didn't want to make a channel without intention. And so like when I made it, I thought, if I'm just going to do a channel that is exactly like the 50 other people that I like, why would I do this? I look at things from a more, how can I bring value to this market? And I thought my value could be that I professionally, I work in politics. I have to stand up and give speeches. I don't get prep time. I'm like, oh, this could be my thing because I can talk relatively smoothly without doing a lot of ums, and I I take notes while I'm reading, so it's easier for me to remember things after I'm done because I've already done a little research before I'm finished with reading the book. I think it's worked because it's something different. Some other people do it. Brian Lee Durfee does the same thing I do, just with somehow less production value. But not a lot of people do it. And so I think that might help, is being a little different.
Hi, Matt. It's Jared. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Jared. Good to see you, man.
Yeah. I really love your delivery and your book reviews. So I find that you said you had a background in politics. So I imagine that really plays into the smoothness of your delivery when you're doing something on the fly like that. I find it amazing. I find I can't deliver anything unless it's written in front of me. So I'm on the other end of the spectrum, I guess. And it, what's funny is I love watching all your reviews, all of them, even though like I disagree with a lot of your stuff, but I love how you present it and put it together as a piece that is your view on what you just read. And you have a consistent ratings, you know, grading system, a consistent system that you have that really you, I know exactly where you're coming from when you're, when you review a book. And I like that a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I mean, because of the style of review I do, it's easier for me to, I think, to be more honest than people that kind of write things out. Because if you write things out and you say something really negatively about something, it can come off very vitriolic. I mean, you thought about this and you planned it out and you scripted this bad thing you had to say. But if I just kind of talk about my honest opinions about it and smile and laugh and try to make it more fun without feeling like I am angry, you know, it can be more endearing than if I was to do, you know, this more with intention. And so it I think it helps because I'm able to talk negatively about stuff, which always gets more clicks. I don't want to do that. I'd rather read books I love. I hate reading books I don't like. It's a waste of like 20 hours. But it can be more fun, and I can do it without feeling like I'm going to hurt feelings, like I feel like some other people might.
Is that ever a concern for you when you go into review and you know that you weren't a big fan of the book and you have things that you just didn't work for you for whatever reason? Do you ever kind of feel is it ever a concern to deliver it in a certain way? Do you worry, well, if the author watches this, I don't know what, you know, I don't want to hurt their feelings, or is it ever a concern for you?
Yeah. So I take contingencies to make sure I don't feel bad. One of those is I don't review books with authors I think I would hurt their feelings if I didn't like it. It's a policy. I have a lot of social anxiety of being very conscious about not offending people, and not in like a trying to jump over myself, but I don't want to hurt people's feelings if I can avoid it. And I always see people hurting people's feelings without knowing it. And I'm like, I need to not do that. So it's an easy thing to say, look, there's a million books out there I could like, let me avoid the ones that are so small that they'll probably read this and be hurt. Another thing I think is when I talk negatively about something outside of one book I've done, which I felt like it was just a plagiarized book, and so I didn't feel bad about being kind of mean. But even then I feel like I had fun with it. And all the others, if I hate a book, I'll very intentionally talk about what did work. And I feel kind of guilty that, you know, when I love a book, I often don't feel like I need to say something negative about it on the flip side. But I do feel like there's a part of me that wants to indicate what I did enjoy. And I also like to say, like, even if I didn't enjoy it, I want to try to make it clear what type of person would enjoy this kind of book. I want any review I do to ultimately make the author money and help them. And I find that even if I like to think about a negative review before I finish a book, and how can I present this in a way that's honest, but also will make the author, well, at least make it neutral for them, and ideally sell them books and make people go, oh, Matt hated it, but I kind of hate Matt's opinions on this, and I kind of like that kind of thing. Or, you know, he doesn't like urban fantasies. I happen to love urban fantasies. And so I try to have that conscious mindset. And if I do those things, then I can't feel guilty about what I do at all.
Yeah. I think it's so funny how tastes can be so different in so many different people. Like, I know you're a huge Malazan fan, and so am I. But on the other hand, I am also a huge Robert Howard fan, and I know you recently did not like that book at all. It's amazing how we can have all these different tastes that commingle, where we agree on so much and we disagree on so much stuff. And so your approach to the reviews really helps bring all that forward and still be in this nice, community type way.
Yeah, Jared, I think that's a good point. And I've, not to get all philosophical, but I've thought about that a lot. And because I consciously try to think of, like, people come to me for recommendations on things, and I'll look at it and say, like, oh, you like these kind of books, you must like this. And that's not true. I mean, there is no test that you can ever do that will tell somebody what kind of book they're going to like or not like.
Right.
Because we have a million different things that make us different. Yeah. And, you know, nobody's going to like the same two things. I constantly try to beat that, but I constantly fail miserably because we're just all so unique. And it's wonderful in a beautiful way that we all may like this general, description of fantasy or, you know, speculative fiction or what have you, but there's like a million different things that we disagree on because we're just all unique.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose at the heart of it, it's all about when we create any content, the one thing we're really hoping for more so than anything else is not a steady stream of, God, you're so right there, Matt. You're so right, Chris. You're so wrong there, Chris. It's about discourse, isn't it? It's about the conversation, about somebody being able to pinpoint and actually say, well, I don't agree with on that point, and this is why, or vice versa. You know, not to really change somebody's opinion, but to kind of give a flavor of the variety of opinions that are out there. And I think that's, if anybody was thinking about either writing good reads reviews or content creation, that's the one thing you're really hoping for. I often say above the subscriber numbers, the view counts and all the rest of it, you put a video out there that generates that kind of a level of interest, you feel like that was worth doing. That was a good use of my time, because for pretty much everybody, like, this isn't our primary day-to-day bit. You know, we're doing it on the side. We want to get something out of it. And the numbers only do that so much. You know, it's about all the things that come from that.
Yeah, and I often think about that, about how I'm just giving my opinion, man. Like, this isn't – I'm not writing this from a, well, you know, because this is this style of book, and if you loved that, then you should grade it this. It's like, well, I didn't like it, you know, and I'm just talking about what I like or don't like. That's it. And I even though it's in my title, I'm not really like a book reviewer. I'm just like a dude giving a hobbyist opinion on something. Even though I might make money on it, it's not like a salary. You know, if I want to listen to a book review, I'll read a magazine book review where they actually know what they're talking about and, you know, have some sort of useful degree in this field. And that's also what I like about BookTube. It's just sometimes I just want to hear what somebody thinks about something, and I don't need to, you know, actually be, just give me your biased opinion.
And a lot of it goes into, I mean, you can read a book, and for if there's something going on in your life, or you're going through a certain period, you may not like a book, and you come back to it later and it really works for you. It was so many different variables in how we absorb material and how we, things that we enjoy or don't enjoy. But I do get a kick out of some of the people who take this a little too seriously. Like, if you can't be a book reviewer if you don't do X, Y, and Z. It's like, come on, like, just relax. It's just for fun, you know?
I get such a kick out of those comments. It fuels me in a very, it says something about my personality type, I guess. But like, when somebody says like some kind of criticism and the more hateful and hurtful it is, the more I get a kick out of it. Because it's like, man, you took this so serious. I'm just, you took more time to do that than it did for me to even think about saying something. Like, you, it's interesting how riled up some people get about a hobbyist thing that is just on a random whim people make.
Yeah. I think it also ties into how much, people get riled up because they kind of sometimes take ownership of things they like, even mm-hmm. though it's just a book, you know, but if I know some people, like, they really like something, they really don't want to hear something bad about it at all. And, they kind of take that to heart when they take ownership of a piece of art like that.
Yeah, I try not to be like that. I think it's easy to fall into that trap internally. It's easy for me to also say it like, yeah, we shouldn't do that. And I don't think I do very often. And then on the other hand, somebody will say something negatively about the 49ers and I'll be like, well, all right, well, now you should die. And so it's hard to be consistent in life, I guess, is my point.
Well, I wish they didn't blow it, but, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, shit, Jared. No. Too soon.
I just wrote a name on my list.
Block juicers.
I'm glad you can make it, Varsha.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me. Yeah, sorry, I was a bit late. I think there was some confusion with the time, but yeah.
That was me. Sorry about that.
Finishing a bit of reading, probably Varsha trying to catch up on something you were late for. Yeah.
Yes. I was supposed to finish this like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. I actually wanted to get PL's view on this one. And kind of as an author, when you see a book review pop up on YouTube or on Goodreads, what is that, I'm sure there's some anticipation of, I wonder if this person liked it or didn't like it. And also after the review, do you notice a jump in sales and attention or kind of, does it help gain traction for your work when you see it, when a popular reviewer reviews it, whether it's good or bad?
You know, you're going to have to forgive the tangent. First of all, you know how much I respect all of you, five of you, in terms of what you do in terms of content. It's just fabulous. And I am now essentially a novice booktuber, but I'm so incompetent with technology that it's actually laughable and I decide to go with it. Like, for example, the first couple of videos I made on YouTube, I had my camera backwards. I didn't realize. So when I held the books up, they were backwards, right? And then one time I didn't turn on my microphone properly. You couldn't hear half the review. And then the third time, I mean, I could go on and on, right? But let's put it this way. Hats off to all five of you. You guys are fantastic, very professional in what you do. I know it's not your full-time gig, but, you know, I can tell you for me, the writing part is easy, man, compared to the book doing part, right? So, and it's funny. I talked about this the other day on I think it was Page Chewing with Tori and Joanna, yeah, and Taylor, that we're talking about, you know, like, you know, you start off doing this BookTube stuff and your first couple of, you look back and you just come like, ooh, my first couple of videos were really cringy, man. They were like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, and then you get better from there, right? So I hope that's going to be me, right? We'll see what happens. But no guarantees right now. Not looking too good right now, but I'm still doing it. And you know what's funny? I made a conscious decision. I had done some research. It's funny, Matt mentioned about reviews, that I had heard, and that from everybody, that reviews don't get a lot of clicks, right? But it's something I really enjoy. And I said, well, I don't care about clicks and subscribers. I want your book reviews. So that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I've probably done predominantly in my channel since I really started up, other than Page Chewing, which is just something that was already going on. So I think when it comes to reviews, I know for me, I still get nervous. I'm certainly not a big enough author not to be. I guess I would love to be in that space, that rarefied air where it's like, a review doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know if I'll ever be like that. I think because I really do value reviews, and it's not just, okay, well, I care whether or not I got a 1-star or a 5-star. I think I honestly value reviews, and it's not just about opinion. I think it's more about input in terms of, you know, because you never want to reach that point as a writer where you want to write your book the way you want to write it, but you don't want to be tone deaf to criticism, yet you still have to be somewhat... You have to insulate yourself against things that may or may not be constructive, right? Because let's face it, there's people out there who, you know, I mean, we talked about clickbait. Some people just like, do you do negative reviews for the sake of doing negative reviews, right? But some reviewers, and it's not about being professional or not, they will give you exceptional feedback and you might pick something up that, you know, you didn't realize perhaps what you're writing. And I always say, if you keep saying and hearing the same things over again in terms of either a positive or negative, that's something you need to look at. If it's a negative, ooh, maybe there's something I need to address in my writing, depending on what it is. And if it's a positive, you need to try and roll with that and maybe, you know, do more of that. So for me, yeah, when I see, especially, like, I feel I'm one of the people, I value everyone's opinion. But of course, I'm susceptible. I'll be lying. I'm susceptible to anyone else to, like, if someone is a BookTuber with a lot of followers and they're going to review my book, or it's someone, I'd say, with a lot of followers, but that... You know, I personally, you know, I elevate them as, oh my gosh, you know, this person's reading my book, right? You know, because I really respect their opinion. And I feel that about, I think, almost pretty well every BookTuber, but I'm just being honest, like, it still matters to me. So, and yeah, I can't lie to you. If a popular BookTuber or someone with a large following puts a review of my book up, sometimes it impacts sales. But I don't really think I don't really worry as much about sales as authors. We all want more sales, but that's not why I write. I think someone like Steve, who knows me well, knows that. I don't write for that. I'm writing to tell a story with a certain message, right? So, but I can't lie to you. Yeah, I mean, I just got a really good review today from, it was written, but from a booktuber who I really respect. And I was like, wow, you know, that was, and I was really humbled by the praise. And then he kind of compared me to two of my favorite authors, and that really blew me away. But at the same time, you know, like, that's all thrilling and everything, but then, you know, you're only a few hours away from your next bad review, right? So you can't get too high or too low. You know, it's not really something that, you know, I know a lot of authors don't look at their reviews, and I wish I was like that. They still matter to me, but no. So, and I don't know if I think they always will, you know, but I respect the honesty in reviews. And I think the one thing you learn as an author is that books are not meant for everybody. Certain books will bounce off some readers, whereas they will totally, other readers will be totally enthralled. And that's what it's all about, right? That's the, I'm not sure if it was Jared or Chris or Varsha Steve that mentioned that, or Matt, but that's what it's life about people having different tastes and different likes and dislikes. It'd be pretty boring if everybody just liked the same damn thing, right? So, yeah.
Great. We talk about that all the time when we're doing our discussions. When we're doing a book discussion about something, we're really hoping that at least one person within the group really doesn't like it or has very different opinions, because there's nothing worse than an echo chamber of five or six people all sitting around discussing a book, all saying every 2 seconds, well, this is just brilliant, isn't it? Because it's not as interesting a conversation. It's just not as much fun to be part of. And it's those ones where somebody or a group of people have very different opinions than me that I come away from those conversations going, they've been the most fun, because not that there was a fight or anything like that, but I kind of learned a bit more insight into other people's mindsets when reading books like that or similar, you know.
Yeah, and you know what, I think the one thing is, I know for myself, I don't write books that I ever believe will be immensely popular. I'm not just saying that. Like, my books are, some people might find it controversial, some people might find it not your flavor, and that's fine. I write for a certain audience, and if they like it, they like it. They don't, they look, I appreciate the ones who do, and the ones who don't, that's fine. So I think the other thing is that, you know, if you knowingly write that type of book, that's going to be essentially what we call Marmite. And it's funny, I'm part of a club of writers, essentially a reading club that, you know, we nicknamed ourselves the Marmite Club, because, you know, Marmite is basically something that people either love or they hate. And that's how I feel about my books. People usually have really strong opinions about my books. Either they really love it or they really hate it. There's not a lot of in-betweens, right? I don't tend to get reviews that, no, it's okay. You know, like, I tend to get, you know, yay, you know, or no friggin' way. So, and but at the same time, I think for most authors, we're pretty well, you do get to a point where you know that you're writing for an audience, and that audience starts to, as it grows, they like your books, and that's who reads them. Especially for me, I'm writing a 7-book series. So, you know, if you're not into at least book two, then you're done. You're gonna tap out, right? So, yeah. Especially with those long series. So, yeah, that's that's definitely something that I do.
So, Varsha, when you have a negative or semi-negative review, does it worry you? Do you, or something negative with whatever it is you're reading, or?
It worries me. Like, I haven't been making videos about this. Like, so mainly my input or contribution towards the book's rating or opinion overall is on Goodreads and how I rate it. And when it's a book that doesn't have a lot of ratings, I worry about if it's negative, then it's going to bring the average down, and that may not be a good enough picture. So I don't rate the book. But if it's got maybe, I don't know, like 300, 400 or more reviews already on Goodreads, then I rate the book with 3 stars or less. I try not to rate books. And I think this is especially important for independent authors. I feel like just that if I honestly don't know how much people set store by the Goodreads average rating, but you also have to look at the number of reviews when you look at that, right? So if it's if you just look at that number, then I think it's going to be bad if one negative review pulls it down. So yeah, I worry in that sense, but I also don't make videos in which I talk about why I don't like a book. In discussions, I think we talk about some things that we do and don't like, but I don't make, we've done that recently, but in general, I think, or, you know, sometimes I do group wrap up videos in which I might say, this wasn't for me, but I don't think I spend too much time harping on it. Mostly I indulge in ranting with my husband, and that's pretty much it.
So, Matt, with your workflow, what would you say takes you the longest? What's the most time consuming part of running a YouTube channel, a BookTube channel specifically?
In terms of the content creation itself, it's if I'm doing something like a ranking type video, because in those videos, I do a fair amount of editing in them to make them actually presentable. You got to put numbers on the screen, you got to put book covers up, you got to animate them. If you want to keep people's eyes on your video instead of just listening, you got to throw up some graphics every now and then. That all takes time. It's easier as you go along because I just save all the pictures and organize them all. But it's still time that I'm not used to doing either. So it's not fun at all. But that's the part that kind of sucks. In terms of like the whole community itself, I spend more time kind of in my community Discord doing a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons I feel like my channel's kind of grown a little bit, is this kind of symbiotic nature between the different social media platforms, and they kind of feed into each other. And so when I'm really active with the community and things like Discord, that turns into a loyal base of people that will want to go to watch all the videos. That helps the algorithms, that helps the whole big picture of things. And so I definitely spend more time on like even doing Discord than even making all my videos combined. But yeah, in videos, it's the long form video content sucks.
Yes.
I couldn't imagine making a top 100 type of video. I can't even think like even going beyond 10. Like I couldn't even think about doing that. It's just getting all that information together and putting it all together and stuff like that. That must have, like, because you've done quite a few of those, and that must have taken you, like, the first time you did that, it must have taken you all weekend or something like that just to get all that information together.
Yeah, you'd think. The problem with me is I definitely have OCD that comes out in my book reading hobby.
Oh, there you go.
You know, I've struggled my whole life with OCD not, like, taking over my life, but I get really focused on one thing in my life and do it a lot. And to an obsessive level. And I've tried over time to not make that things like video games or things I feel like aren't going to help me, my brain. And I've focused over the last large handful of years to make it books and this whole getting reviews out thing in a consistent manner. But one of the ways my OCD-ness comes out with reading books is that I keep an obsessive amount of data about the books that I've read. After I've read them. I mean, so I have an obscenely big spreadsheet of how much I read every day and, how many words per day, over time, and audiobooks versus books, and what's it looking like I'm going to read this year on a projection basis. And that's kind of partly, I think it's really helped my channel, because I do things that most people don't because I have this problem, where because of that, I have to know what books I'm going to be reading in the long-term future. I have a huge list of a TBR. It's not a loose TBR. I will read those books. And I know when I will read them because I know how much I read per day, on average. And so on a list like a top 100 list, well, that was really easy because I just went to my list that said top books because they're all ranked. Because when I finish a book, I have to rank it and think about it and move it around. And that's why it's made it easy for me to do videos like that because I already have that data. Wow. I mean, I do one of the videos that really blew up my channel at the beginning, which made it go from, oh, this is nobody's watching my videos, to, oh, wow, I just got monetized. instantly because I made this video where it was like, what's the best book every year for the past like 40 years that I've read? Well, that would be really hard for somebody to figure out, except if you're like me and you already have a spreadsheet that shows the date of every book that's written that you've read and you just sort it. So that's it's part of the reason I do videos like that is I feel like I can do something that other people can't or don't want to spend the time obsessing over because I already did it for them.
I can. I know like the last book, the books I've read over the past year are somewhere over there. I don't. I'm definitely not that organized at all.
That's one of the failings of Goodreads, actually, because I obviously do movie reviews and stuff as well, and Letterboxd should be the equivalent. Actually lets you pick by year, lets you pick by a decade, you know, just the films that you've logged in that period, and it makes that kind of video like incredibly easy then. Like it's phenomenal. Like I can even export it if I really want to, like it's and just kind of sort through it and delete it and kind of do it really quickly. Whereas you're right, Matt, like I was like trying to do it for books is like without some sort of system that you've created yourself, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it would take, assuming we're all well read and we've read hundreds of books, that would take hours and hours and hours and hours of the most boring thing you could possibly conceive of.
Do you also script those videos, or do you already know what you might say about the book from your spreadsheet?
I know what I'm going to say. I mean, if I do a list video of like a top 100 video where I'm doing a different top 10 every week or two, I do have a teleprompter so that I don't have to look off screen to tell me like what book is next. So I on my teleprompter, I'll say like number 86, this is the author, this is the book, this is the number it is in the series, this is the year it came out. And then it says talk, you know, and then I go to the next one. I don't ever try to prep things out because I want it to sound like I didn't prep. And the only way I can sound like that is by not doing it. Otherwise it would sound a lot different and cleaner. And I want to sound raw and like I want to pause and think about stuff. Because that's just kind of the presentation I want to go for.
That's good stuff. You know, what's funny. I started, and again, I go back to my technical competence. So at first, I couldn't figure out how to just do videos without going live. So I just basically, everything was live. But then I was like, when I figured out how to just record a video and post it later, I was like, but you know what? There's something about, and it's exactly what Matt said. There's something about just, you read a book, you have an opinion, and just spontaneously you go on there and just go blah and just vomit out what you think about it, right? And it's real, it's candid. There's this authenticity to doing that. And once I started doing it, I was like, you know what? I'm kind of enjoying this, right? And so I just kept doing it. And it was just mostly, again, by accident because I was so technologically challenged. And I was just like, okay. But then when I started doing it, I was like, you know what? This is working. So, yeah.
I mean, I think the problem with doing it also at the beginning is you're going to be more shy. Or at least I was at the beginning, which is strange because I can talk really well in front of, you know, 1,000 people. But, you know, you put me up on a video that an unknown amount of people are going to be watching and judging is different. And so at least for me, I wasn't myself for the first large handful of videos. I was some other guy. And it took me a while. So if I go back and look at it, I think a normal person would look at it and be like, oh, Matt's totally faking it now. He acts totally different. But it's like, no, that's, you know, I'm trying to act like there's actually a person behind that camera instead of like a piece of machinery that sucks out the soul of you. At least, you know, when I first started making videos. So my first videos suck. I mean, it is just, it's soulless.
Well, you know, Sean, man, you look pretty smooth to me now anyways on camera. So I got to say you look pretty, pretty polished, but it is weird. Like, I don't know how the rest of you feel, but yeah, I mean, I'm generally a pretty confident dude. And when I'm interviewing other people, like for page chewing with Taylor or myself, I'm totally relaxed. I'm like having a blast, blah, blah. But then trying to post a review about a book that, I mean, I know how I felt. I'm at first fumbling my way through everything. And, you know, it's just so weird how certain situations can be much more nerve-wracking, like Matt's implying, than, you know, like, I mean, if you know what I do for a living, like, I have no problem speaking publicly, right? Or speaking in front of people, or, you know, being assertive. But then, you know what, you know, I was so nervous doing my first three reviews and, you know, bumping my words. And it was just, yeah, it was really weird. So,
yeah. Yeah. Part of the problem with doing it unscripted is this concept that, you know, you're probably going to say something wrong, like legitimately factually wrong. And oftentimes something really stupid. I mean, I finished a book and said the wrong book title. You know, and partly it's like, well, I read the book title once and then I read the book. You know, I wasn't focused on the book title. Or like, you'll just say the wrong character's name or something totally wrong. And people then, especially if the video suddenly gets exposure, is they'll be like, did you even read the book? You know, all these, you know, this sucks. And it's like, well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't study for it. I just read it once and I might have been distracted. So I don't know. It opens you up to a lot of, you know, people calling you out on stuff pretty often when you do that.
Yeah. When I first started, I did at least 3 or 4 takes every time I was doing a review. Cause I didn't like how it came out. I didn't like how I stuttered. I didn't like, you know, all the 400 ums that were in the middle of it. And you know, I stuttered through when I first started. I was at least recording, not going live like PL, but it took me a while. It took me a while to do it 3 or 4 or 5 times or whatever, you know? So finally I got it down to 1 or 2 takes nowadays, but when I first started, it was rough.
Yeah. I think also for like from a mental health perspective, it's good, not to over dramatize it, but it's good not to spend too much time on stuff that you don't really like. You know, I've seen every time I see somebody get burnt out on something like BookTube, it's the exact same reason. As they go, I hate the preparation. I hate the editing. And every single one of them is end up what they're saying. And I'm spending too much time on this. And if people just from the beginning had this mindset of stop caring so much, just have fun and do it for you. And if other people happen to enjoy it too, that's cool. But do whatever you like doing and stop focusing on stuff that annoys you in life. Just focus on things that make you happy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think a lot of people start channels and have too high of expectations?
Yeah. I definitely see it with people where they'll either rightfully or wrongfully, they'll at the beginning say, this is really easy. Or they'll get a really big video because the algorithm liked it and they'll go, okay, now this is going to be my job. Because if I made this much money per day for the rest of my life, I'd make a ton of money. And that's not how YouTube works, bro. It's random. You never know. There's no, this isn't a linear game here. And so it's that gambling thing where you get this fever for it. And so I see that a lot from people, and the way they react, I think, says a lot about why they're doing their channel. Because what a lot of people do, and I don't mind saying this about people because I don't have to make friends, but like what a lot of people do is they'll say, let me focus on those videos that did well. Yeah. Let me play the data game. And undoubtedly it's going to take you down these roads that very quickly that are going to suck the soul out of you because they're not why you did it in the first place. It's going in the totally wrong direction. And so constantly it's almost like then it turns into their job that you're not actually getting paid salary money for. And I feel bad for those people because it doesn't feel like a worthwhile piece of time for somebody to do for the value they're getting back.
Yeah, I know plenty of those stories. I know people who are obviously they get to a certain size and they think, well, actually, if it's just a bit bigger, I could actually make some real money, etc. And they start to do exactly what you're saying, Matt. I know a lot of these stories of people that do the pay for tube buddy so that they get all the hot SEO words and that they can go and do. So they make the videos that the SEO tells them to make, And then those videos don't do that well. So they ended up putting a lot of time and energy into making a video that they didn't really think about or want to do in the first place, because they thought it was going to do, and they do their best with it, and then it doesn't perform. And then rather than kind of scrapping that and going, let's just do what I want to do, they go, no, it was the wrong word. So they go back to the app again and go, right, give me different titles or different things that I need to be talking about. And then they get into the, what wasn't the right timing of it. Like you were saying, actually, about that John Gwynbook having an early review of that out. You know, they're like, well, I have to be first. So they like kind of rush through the content, barely read it. Do you have that just to be the first video that's out about that, etc.? And not kind of, for me anyway, think about, right, what is it that I want to do at the time? If I'm going to invest any time in this whatsoever, what would I like to do about this? And for me currently, that's not making my own videos. That's just kind of doing chats with other people and that varsity the editing. And and that's good for me at the moment. That's absolutely fine.
I don't do any editing, Chris. So whatever you say goes on the internet.
I can tell. It's fine. I joke. But yeah, but just do what you want to do, you know, and kind of
but be yeah, that. I mean, there are some people, a very small amount of people that have actually made it a career. Some of them have made it a career, and they must, you know, not want a very high quality of living, because I know they're not making that much. but there are some people that are legitimately making money out of it, and I get it more there. Go make your money. You know, yeah. Not everybody has a job they love, and they got to find something to make money. So if that's your job, I get it. But if it's your hobby, that's a totally different story for me.
That would scare the shit out of me if I was dependent on YouTube or any platform for income like that. If that was my sole source of income, I don't know how, just thinking about it's scary.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm very fiscally conservative, not in my political beliefs necessarily, but the way I budget my money. And that would terrify me. I mean, I try to take as few risks in life when it comes to money as possible, because I have a family to pay for. And, you know, I'm happy. I don't need to make a lot more money. I'm happy. And I just don't want to lose it. And so doing something like YouTube as a career sounds absolutely nerve-wracking.
Yeah, these platforms are a bubble, man. And, you know, you never know when the bubble's going to burst. And it is, I agree, it's terrifying. I would think to rely on something that could be here today and go, as popular as YouTube has been and as great as it's been. And there are people as Matt and everybody point out that are actually making money doing this stuff. Like, yeah, I would be, I couldn't handle it, man, because you know, what if tomorrow some new regulation comes out and YouTube is restricted from having people making videos about books? That could happen, right? You know, it's not beyond the realm of imagination. So yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people get into that problem where they're kind of at the size of a channel where I am, where you are actually making, you know, more money than you should. You know, I don't no offense to everybody, but like, I shouldn't be making money. I'm reading books and talking about them. But for somehow that is a value I still don't understand it. But like they're making money, and every now and then you'll have a month where you make a lot of money. And I think what you have to do to keep your sanity and to have fun is to say, this is the most amount of money I'll ever make from this. And try not to run into this trap of saying, now I got to go chase that, because it's probably never going to happen. I mean, I take sponsorships for my channel. I'm totally shameless about it. I'm not a huge thing. If you want to pay me money, that's, you know, jokes on you. I don't think you're converting a lot of customers by having this jokester of a book reviewer talk about your product that has nothing to do with books. So yeah, give me your money. That's great. But I had one that paid like a shockingly large amount of money. And it's like, it opened my eyes to the world that a lot of people are living in, where there's a lot of money flinging around. But it's like, my wife and I were just laughing about it. Like, why would they pay you that much? You're nothing. And it's like, I'll never make that again. You know, it was a freak incident, and let's move on with life. So I just I think people should have that mindset to make them more at peace with themselves and not have to make assumptions about the future.
For those that never seen it, Matt made one of the greatest product placement things I've ever seen. The one where was the reading stand and the Amazon clicker, where you basically wrapped yourself up in a cocoon and you could just read a book with just inches from your face, and you could just use a clicker so you never had to move your hands. I loved that, Matt. That was fantastic. And all the discourse in the comments, I remember just saying I would be asleep within seconds. It would be just the greatest sleep aid ever.
Before I did that, I was telling my wife, because I've used this thing and I heard nobody talking about this thing. And it was like, I would brag about it. Like, I'd have a relative come over to my house and be like, come on, Sarah, you got to see this. You got to see my reading stand. And they'd be like, oh, cool, I guess. But I'm like, no, this is cool. Like, people would think this is cool. You don't understand. And so when I posted it, like, I knew people would like it. And my wife is like, she's like a TikTok watcher. And so she's like, no, you need to like get money off this from Amazon and product place link it. And she set it all up for me, and legitimately hundreds of people bought it. As soon as they saw it. So they, all of a sudden this company must've been like, what the hell?
Never underestimate people's propensity to be lazy. You mean I don't have to lift my arm to turn the page in the Kindle? That's gotta be worth a few pounds for sure.
Yeah, what do you think? I'm gonna take my arm out of the blanket to turn a page?
These are life's big problems.
That's the perfect Wall-E situation there.
Oh yeah, it's bad. Yeah, you don't want to see that I got my bag of pretzels underneath the blanket too.
Welcome, Carl. Glad you can make it. Sorry about the confusion.
All good. I'm here to be a little bit of a jump scare. You know, I just wanted to pop in when you least expect it.
We were all very frightened, for sure.
Good. I could tell. Your faces were really pale. I saw all the blood on your face. I didn't have that.
I'm Irish. I'm Irish. That's genetic.
Oh, that's true. Oh, I think it was just a little bit. I didn't even mention it. Yeah.
So Matt, with your channel, what are there any I guess what is your least favorite part of running your channel?
I think my least favorite part is managing something that I did, that I, a problem I caused. But I started a Patreon and people joined it. I don't really know why. I've never bought a Patreon for anybody and don't really plan on it. But I had this bright idea one day and I'm like, I should open up like a really expensive tier. And then every like few months I'll buy somebody a book, and send it to them with like a note from Amazon about why I picked it for them. And like, they can show me their Goodreads account and I can kind of figure out something I think they'd like. And then, you know, people signed up for it. And then I got to like actually research stuff now and go buy books. And then like, you know, oh, this person lives in Iceland. Like, okay, I guess I got to figure out some like Icelandic company that'll ship a book. So like, there's a lot of effort now that I'm putting into something that I feel bad about just like canceling, because then I'd have to like, I don't know. I don't want to disappoint people that are all excited about it. And I picked like six books for people and I'm like, I'm out of choices. I don't know. Or somebody will sign up and I'll be like, you only read romance fantasy books. Okay. I guess I got to research things now. So that's the part I hate the most for sure. And I don't really see a way out of it, but whatever.
Somebody has figured out that it's cheaper to get books, you to send books to Iceland than actually pay for the shipping themselves from Amazon. It's genius in their part if you think about it. Like, it's really very good, you know.
Yeah, no, there's some people I'm not making much money off. I mean, there's this person that lives like, I'm not joking, dude. They live more in the like in the random Brazil highlands with like 100 people living in this little like place they live. and I got to ship it to like the main city, and then they got to reroute it to their little village or whatever. And it's like, I'm making no money off this person. And it's like, whatever. It's kind of fun knowing that this whole thing's going on and this person's happy and you know, whatever. I said I'd do something and I'll do it.
Well, if you're ever in any doubt of what books to send them and you run out of ideas, I recommend P.L. Stewart's The Drowned Kingdom and The Truth of Crowns by a guy called Carl Lee Albert. There are two choices you could just kind of throw in there. And maybe the worst part is they might not be in your top tier subscribers anymore, but there's also a problem solved for you, Matt. You know, that's...
There we go. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about that Carl Albert guy. I hear he's a novice. So. Right. I might hold back on that one.
You're too kind, Chris. Thanks, Wade. You're a good guy. You're too kind. Thank you.
Varsha, do you pay attention to performance or like the analytics of your? Do you ever look at the analytics page? And if you do, why?
Why? I do look at it. I can't say that it has dictated any decisions I make, but yeah, I like to know. For instance, the most recent video that came out, for instance, has like 45 views, which compared to like general average views on my channel, you'd think is doing great. But it has a watch time of 1.5 hours, which means a total of one person has watched it, or several people have watched it for like 2 minutes. So I don't know. I just like to know that people are watching this. I guess it makes me happy. So that's all. Like if I have a watch time of greater than zero people having watched the video all the way through, that makes me happy. Discussions, I mean, just being in a discussion, I feel great about. The solo videos I make, I think I like to track those more. Again, more for feeling good than for anything else. But yeah, I was, as a follow-up to Matt and everyone else, if you look at your analytics, have you let it dictate any of your decisions that you make, like what content you'll make on your channel, or if you'll make more of one particular type of video than others?
I look at it for the other type of videos I make. Like I'll use that data to help me figure out how to make, if I'm like, oh, I'm making this top 10 video, you know, I want it. That's the one type of video where I actually want it to do well, because I actually put effort into it. So if I'm going to put effort into it, I might as well cheat and figure out the things to do to make it work, or the things that have worked on my past videos and made them work. I also kind of use it because I want to figure out, because I do advertise on my channel, I work with a lot of different advertising companies. And what I like to make it really simple for people to say, like, hey, I'm going to make this video. This is probably how many views it's going to get. You know, I know based on what it is, it's going to get this. So you tell me what kind of video you want to do and how much money we should pay out. I don't care. Just let's figure out what it is. But the easier I make it on people to be able to predict what kind of views I'm getting based on the past data is really helpful. It makes the business side of things really easy, because then you don't really have a big negotiation back and forth. It's really simple. It's like, this is not what you're paying. This is what you're going to get. And so, yeah, that's why I look at it. But not for my reviews and stuff. No, it's just kind of interesting more than anything.
Makes sense. And for the authors, have you, Carl and PL, have you guys... changed anything that you would write in later in the series based on reader reviews and any feedback that you've received from people you've sent your book out to, like not the beta readers, like people from whom you expect to change books from, but when it's out in the wild, have you made any decisions based on just general feedback or ratings and things like that?
PL, I don't know if you want to go first. I you have more books out than I do, so you might be able to speak to this a little better.
No, not that doesn't qualify me for anything, man. But thank you for letting the old man go first, right? Age before beauty.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, no. You know what? To be honest with you, no. Short answer is no. I think it's more at the beta read stage. Varsha's question that you might change something. But once you've pretty well solidified that final draft and it's been edited 3 times and 4 times and 10 times and you looked at it and you looked at it 50 times and you still missed that capital S that should be small s, and you know, and all of that, it's pretty well, yeah, it's a done deal. And I think there's a point, I'd like to hear what Carl thinks, but I know for me, there's a point where the book just has to be good enough to go out there. I mean, you could spend 10 years sitting on a book, editing it constantly and revising it constantly, but then that's 10 years that it's not published. So there's got to, you know, and I can't give you a quantitative, this is when it's ready. I can't tell you that. You just know. I know that sounds very airy-fairy, but yeah, you just know when it's ready to go, and you know it's been edited enough, and you know you've written the book that you're proud to put out there, and then you let it go, and then you move on, because guess what? You want to write the next book. So at least that's my experience, and that's my experience with writing 4 books and now about to get the 5th one put out there soon. So, and yeah, you take the feedback, and you take the positives and negatives, and yeah, you just kind of go from there, because I know for me, I started writing very late in life, in my 50s. So, you know, knowing that you have more years behind you than ahead, you figure, okay, well, if I want to write 20 or 30 books, I better get my, you know, one gear. So I kind of got to that point where, okay, yeah, this book is good enough, quote unquote, and it's out. So,
yeah, if you're going to bounce off that, I was just going to go on a little brief ramble, but go for it, Matt.
Well, I just wanted to chime in real fast to ask, because you mentioned you spend, you know, a lot of time in that editing stage. Do you hate the editing as much as we talked about on the video side of things? I mean, I assume you want to write books, right?
Oh, man, I despise editing. It's the most necessary evil, but that's a thing, like, I mean, just, you know, gags me, man. Like, I would... It is, again, the most essential part of any book is especially the line editing. So you have a pretty clean manuscript and that, you know, you're not having, again, all those capital S's where they used to be small S's and punctuation missing and stuff like that. And I have to say, you know, like, and I'm not saying this, please, I'm not denigrating my traditionally published author friends because they're great authors. And in this case, it's 99% their publishers. But I've got tons of mistakes in traditionally published books, tons, all kinds of mistakes in trad books. However, there's still potential right now. I don't know how Carr feels. I think there's still, or how all you feel, there's still a bit of a stigma when it comes to indie writing in terms of, I think, and I'm not saying woe is me and Cry Me a River, or woe is us, should I say. But I think indie authors are judged a bit more harshly on their editorial mistakes. So
that's true.
I think there's an emphasis for us on getting a pretty clean manuscript, especially when it comes to the spelling and the grammar and the punctuation, stuff like that. Cause they'll find all your mistakes, man, for sure. So, yeah. You know, but yeah, editing is drives you crazy, because just when you think you've had 50 million eyes on the thing, your betas, you know, your dog, you know, all of your editors, right? If sometimes you have multiple editors, you know, like probably your spouse or your partner gives it a last one through, you give it a million run throughs till you're tired of seeing what you wrote, right? And then you still miss that punctuation, or you still, like, it's just, yeah, it drives you nuts. So
I'm a freak. I love editing. It's my favorite part of the process. But like, I relate a lot to Joe Abercrombie. Will talk a lot about how in the first draft, he loathes it, because he's like, this is not the thing I imagined in my head. This is, you know, I'm a hack. Everyone's going to see that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And while I don't know that I necessarily loathe my first draft, it's not what I want it to be, not even close, whether it's in, you know, the quality of the prose, or, you know, I'm still working out kinks in the story, things like that. And so I love seeing it actually like come together and more closely align with what my vision of it is. And particularly if, you know, I love also getting feedback and kind of applying that feedback and seeing the story from different perspectives. So, I mean, to speak to Varsha, what you were asking, I'm so early on in my career that I don't know, you know, I feel it would be remiss of me to like confidently state one way or another, you know, I mean, my readership is so small at this point too, that like I even with my limited readership, I can say that you have to be careful with the feedback you get, because whether it's from beta readers or readers who are reading the finished book or whatever, the advice is always conflicting, right? I had one reader who told me, you know, oh, the ending of your book was my favorite part of the book. It was so climactic. It's very explosive. You know, a lot of great reveals and twists and turns. And I thought it really came together at the end there. And then I had another reader, a book vlogger, who was like, yeah, I really liked the book, but the ending I just felt was a little rushed. And, you know, you're like, okay, well, who do I believe? And ultimately, the only person you can believe is, you know, or trust in is yourself and your taste. Right. And so I certainly haven't changed any plot lines fully, just based off of, you know, I'm writing book two now, I'm really deep into it, and I haven't changed tact, you could say, with anything, based on reader feedback, other than, you know, the readers that I specifically enlist, my beta readers, my editor, AP, right? Like their feedback is huge, but again, it's often contradictory. You know, it often conflicts. Even feedback that they themselves give sometimes contradicts itself. You know, humans are complex creatures, and our emotional and intellectual reactions to works of fiction can be just as complex as we are. And so, you know, I to some degree, I think it's just a matter of trusting your gut and, you know, being open to criticism, but knowing, you know, you have a plan. And particularly speaking to myself and my process as a writer, while the story changes as I go, you know, I'm very much a pantser. I hate outlining. I hate it. But that said, I still like, there are places I know I need to go in the story. And so if I change my plan based off of what, you know, one or two or 100 readers say, you know, that has the risk of me blowing up, you know, everything I'm setting up, everything I have set up. To speak to a series that I adore, the Red Rising series by Pierce Brown, in the latest book, Lightbringer, I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's a plot line that to me very clearly read as, Pierce has been very open about how much he struggled with Lightbringer. And there's a plot line that was introduced in the previous book that is basically dropped in Lightbringer. And it really frustrated me as a reader, honestly, because it was this huge, like, it just changed everything. And I think he realized he didn't, I mean, we'll see, there's one more book to go, but I very much got the feeling that it, you know, if you change, you know, your path completely, it can be really frustrating, right? To readers and potentially to yourself. And so I think you have to have a certain amount of control in that way. And that's a benefit that outliners have, is, you know, if they actually stick to their outline, then, you know, everything is cleanly set up and they don't have to worry about getting really jumbled or, you know, making the story in the end a mess, which is not to say Lightbringer is a mess. I want to say I actually really enjoyed the book, but just there's this one plot line without, you know, spoiling it, that I felt like was just completely dropped.
You know, it's funny, and hats off to you, Carl. That was really well said. That was exceptionally well said. And I do admire the integrity to stick to, you know, what you intended. I'm the same way. And I think for me, it's funny when you say, and lots of fellow writers that are more on the pantser side, I'm an obsessive, you know, crazy plotter, right? Like, I plot beyond, like, I have all the titles planned out for 20 plus books. I have all the back cover blurbs planned. I have all the covers planned. I have, like, I'm crazy, right? I have every single plot thread planned out, and with some room for variation here and there, but not a lot. And, you know, but I don't know if that just makes me crazy, or, but for me, it's liberating, and it just means I can focus more on the writing. Like, and maybe because I have so many books planned in this universe, I feel like it just frees me up to just focus on the writing, right? But yeah, at the same time,
you, by the way, I wish, sure, I could do, I'm jealous of you, PL. I wish I could be a better outliner. Like, that's what my training is. I work in the entertainment industry. I'm also pursuing a career as a screenwriter, and you have to outline everything, right? Because you have to give the executives something so that they see, you know, they have to green light things, right? People don't just, like, blindly write scripts. I mean, you have to be really well established to do that. But my outlines end up sucking because they end up, I inevitably start writing and I'm like, oh, this character wouldn't do that. Or like, this is terrible. Like, I don't know what I was thinking. And, you know, I talked about how, you know, I love editing because that's where I kind of find the story. I wish I could outline, but I'm just bad at it. Like I genuinely,
no, but
it's yeah.
But at the same time, I really admire, like, I mean, I talk about life would be boring if, like, it's great that you have, there's going to be a level of spontaneity in what you do, and that's going to be a positive for your writing, right? Like, there's no roadmap for writing a book, right? Like, that's why there's so many people who are pantsers, so many people who are plotters, and they both works, both types of ways of doing it work. It's just, it needs to work for you, right? I couldn't do it that way, but it doesn't mean that your book won't be fabulous, you know, pantsing it out, right? So, and that's the beauty of life, right? That we all have these differences, right? So, no, but hats off to you for doing that.
Well, likewise to you.
Well, I got to run, guys. Thank you very much.
See you, Jared.
Jared, great to see you, buddy.
See you, Jared. Enjoy the steak.
Yeah. Ooh, I'm a little still. I wanted to ask Matt about the teleprompter because I've been trying to look for ways to script my videos. Like, I don't necessarily script, but I write a bunch of things to say, and then I don't follow the order. So I'm curious. Like, do you use software or do you have a physical thing set up in front of you? And yeah, just what does your setup look like there?
Yeah, so. If you go in the budget to mid-tier teleprompters, they're all made the same way, just with different materials. If you're talking about like doing TV, it's probably built differently, but the stuff you'll find on Amazon is all the same product, just more sturdier than the other. And essentially, you put it on your tripod, you hook your camera to that new unit, which is now sits up higher, and it's really cool that it just reads right in front of your image, whatever you want to say. And so the way mine works, I assume most of them do, is I script out whatever it is, and then I save it as a Word doc, and then you just open up on top of the you open up an app in something that you're going to read it off, like a tablet. They have like an app for that company, and you just say upload, and then you go to an IP address on your computer, and you just upload it, and then sitting right there, you have a controller that just either plays it, stops it, or just jumps page, and it makes it really seamless. And it's also really nice, even if you're not, I also use a teleprompter even for videos that I'm not scripted, and it just says, look here, because it makes me look right at the camera, instead of the natural inclination a lot of people have on unscripted stuff is to, you know, wander all over the place, because that's how people talk usually. They look around, they think. But the teleprompter really helps you just actually make your eyes contact with the audience, which is pretty cool.
Nice. That's really cool. Yeah, I'm gonna look into maybe trying that out.
Yeah, get a cheap one. You don't have to spend very much money to make it work.
Do you just do like an outline for your videos, or do you like straight up script them? Because I know with your reviews, a lot of times you're doing it like you at least start out really spontaneously, right? Like that's kind of your hook, right?
I just write. I write the author's name and the book name. And the year it came out, because I made too many mistakes on that, and people just laugh. Yeah. So I want to get those basic facts right, and then I just talk.
YouTube comments can be brutal, so I understand that.
It's funny, my process is a little different, especially from reviews, because I don't do very many reviews. I tend to actually really think about what I'm going to say from reviews, because I went back and forth in a couple of different ways, but I wanted this busy talk with thematics, and hopefully, but like yourself, Matt, somebody who talks all day for a living, I don't need to script my views. I'm sort of hoping to get into that free flow state that I do in my day job, insofar as I want to, again, have that natural feel to it. So I just kind of want to make sure that I'm talking about a couple of things that I want to mention within it. So they tend to be a bit more considered than any other content that I'm making, like a recommendation video or a wrap-up video or something. I will just do off the cuff. I literally have a stack of books beside me, and they go, this book, look at it occasionally, go, can't remember, hold on to look up what the main character's name was or something of that regard. I have literally nothing to do. And then kind of edit that in. But the reviews are trying to do something a bit more intentional with. And to that end, even though they don't get the mass amount of views, like any interaction in that is good. It's a bit like PL and Carl were saying as well, in terms of like when they put themselves into the writing, the discourse about what that writing is the thing that you want to get out of it. And in the same way, I'd like to get that out of my reviews. My other stuff, I don't care. Most people are saying, I've read that book, I haven't read that book, or whatever it is, I like that book. Like, it is very kind of cursory stuff, but even feedback and discourse and reviews tends to be a bit more thoughtful and considered. Same with our discussions as well. When people are commenting on the discussions, it's very much, yeah, I agree with this part or not, you know?
Yeah, and kind of what Carl and Peele were talking about, where they have these different styles of writing. You know, there is no right way to do like a casual book review. I think in general, you should write the review that you think you'd be good at writing. I'm not a very good writer. I don't like writing. Whenever I have to write for my job, I just do like press releases and I do one draft. And if somebody tells me to edit something, I growl at them. So that's why I do what I do. But if you're good at writing longer form stuff and you can actually put some intention into it, then that's what you should do. And write stuff that you would want to read. And it is kind of a good kind of benchmark to go for.
But yeah. You know, the thing is, though, is like, and you know, I totally concur with what Matt's saying. I know that I'm a much better written reviews than I am at doing oral reviews. So I'm learning. But there's really something good about going outside of your comfort zone, especially as someone who's, you know, a graybeard like me, trying something new. Like I said, fumbling around with YouTube, trying to get the camera backwards, having the mic off. Like, that's all good for me, right? Making mistakes and, you know, and knowing that I'm not saying I'm great at writing reviews. I'm saying that my reviews, I'm saying I know that I'm better at that and more comfortable with that than doing reviews on YouTube. But I feel like anything else in life, I've learned practice. With practice, you get better. And I think it is great to get outside of your comfort zone and work on something that you know you're probably not as comfortable with or you're not going to do as well. So that's the other joy I've found in doing YouTube. And I have my own channel now and doing reviews on YouTube is that, you know, I feel very comfortable writing written reviews, right? No problem whatsoever. But I'm horribly uncomfortable sometimes doing reviews on YouTube. But it's been a good thing. So
Peele, I'm curious about something. And Carl, same question for you. But there seems to be an unspoken rule amongst authors that you typically, when I see a review from an author, it's usually a 5-star review for someone else, and it's always like this glowing, like, oh, I loved it. And it's like, do you really like, I wonder if there's like an expectation of if I do a review, if you didn't enjoy something, you say, you know what, I'm just not gonna say anything. But if you're like lukewarm on it, is there an expectation of doing like, is there like an unspoken rule to say, if you're gonna review a book, it better be a 5-star, just because it's like one of those things? Is that a thing, or is it just because I very rarely trust author reviews because they're always 5-star glowing reviews. It's like, you can't like this many books this much. Like,
well, you know what? You're probably gonna think I'm full of crap. So, and I totally respect it if you do because of what I'm about to say. And, you know, something drawing on what Matt said earlier, and I think, Chris and Varsha might have echoed it in terms of doing reviews. Like, so I've reached a point in my life where I tend to read books that ahead of time I know I'm probably going to like. And I really, really stay away from books that, ooh, I'm going to bounce off that book. And now sometimes, mind you, of course, there have been the instances, I mean, come on, where I've read a book and I thought I was going to be blown out of my socks. It's like, ooh, this didn't really. And then sometimes I read a book where I thought, okay, it's going to be pretty good, and it totally wowed me. But that said, I'm really selective now about books that I read. So I kind of read and then with the intention of, this is going to be a 5-star that I'm going to be able to gush about and rave about. And mostly that happens. Now, I do have a policy. I can't remember if it was Matt that spoke about policies. We all have our own unique thresholds and little rules about, I think, how we do reviews, all of us here. And so my thing is that if I read a book that is less than 3-star for me, I will never review it. You'll never hear anything from me on social media anywhere about, because you know, even if it is a really big traditionally published author that has hundreds of thousands of views, that my review means zero to them. I'm just one of those guys, like, I just find it hard to be really, really, it's not an Aussie thing. It's just me, it's my intro. And I think it's a fault. I think it's a failing of mine. I don't like to speak negatively about books, I guess, to a point where I feel like I'm going on about them, right? And that's just me. It doesn't mean it like I said, I think it's a failing. But so what I would do, if it's, say it's an author gave me an arc, I felt that book just really, I bounced off it, I would message that author and say, hey, you know what? Unfortunately, that book really didn't work for me. You know, this is why. If you'd like me to give you individual feedback, I will, but we'll do it privately. And that will never see the light of day, right? It's as if I never read that book. And I'm very particular because being an indie author, and no, perhaps it's not fair because, again, you know, we should be all judged the same, Indian traditional, it's all books. Whatever. I am sensitive, though, the fact that I can't remember if it was Varsh that said, yeah, this is an indie author who's got 5 reviews, and I certainly don't have a following or influence, but I'm saying if somebody just happens to read my review and it's a 1-star and they go, ooh, you know what I mean? If for whatever reason they think I know what I'm talking about, that could potentially affect that author, right? So I wouldn't, being an indie author myself, I know how much it means, I wouldn't be able to do that. But so when you see me do a lot of 4- and 5-star reviews, I honestly like the thing is because of the way I select books. Like there's lots of books I've gone, you know what? It's a really popular book. People are raving about it. I'm like, I don't think I'm going to like it. And I don't touch it. I don't touch it, man. I stay far away because, you know, it's like, that might be my kryptonite. Right. And I've been trying hard to finish series that I've started because I've been horrible at that. I've been horrible at starting book one and not coming back. So now one of my resolutions is trying to finish series where I start the first book. And obviously if I start the first book and I liked it, I'm probably going to like the rest of the series. So, and that's been the case. So that's what I've been. So if you see all these glowing 4- and 5-star reviews, I know you might think it's bull crap, but honestly, that's why I feel there's so many of them that I put out there.
PL, I'm so excited that you brought this up because I never get an opportunity to talk to like an author like this because I don't, it's hard for me to find time to do these kind of things because my priority is kind of like with my family and this is when things are free, which isn't a lot because I like to spend time with my kids. But I've long thought that policy you just brought up is a policy that I've heard from many other authors that review. This idea that I'm going to be honest with you, but I'm not going to tell you all of my opinions on the different books. I'll hide my opinion on these. And I would probably do the same thing if I was an author. And I ultimately kind of think, and I'm interested in your thoughts, is that a lot of times when you're reviewing a book, not necessarily UPL, but a lot of authors that are reviewing books, especially for more unknown books, although a lot of ways you're doing that review for the author to get better and to learn, where I kind of view what I'm doing a lot of as I'm doing my review for the reader. You know, that's why I'm doing this. And I think that's also why I don't get enjoyment out of it, but I like being able to give a negative review to something because I think the reader has a duty, or not a duty, but I think they have a right to know everyone's opinions on something. I would hate this idea. And obviously I feel bad for the author, but that somebody goes and reads a book because it only had good reviews. But turns out not everybody actually liked it. They just weren't being honest with you about, you know, but they were actually thinking about things. So I don't know if, do you kind of think that's the same for you and a lot of authors is the reason you're doing a review? And I think that's a laudable reason if that's why. I'm not castigating it, but.
No, you hit the rule ahead, nail ahead. Sorry, Matt. And you know, obviously you hear what Carl say, but yeah, you're totally right. I agree with you implicitly in that. As a rule of thumb, I think reviews are for readers, right? So you don't like my book, put a 1-star, and guess what? Someone who everything you put in that review that you didn't like, they may go, oh, this is everything I like, and then they buy the book. So that's another reason why it's so important that reviews are genuine, because everyone's tastes are so different, and what one person treasures, another person thinks is trash. But yeah, I do think, especially when it comes to my peer indie authors, when we review each other's books, yeah, it's a lot more, it's not to say that one person knows more than the other, or one person is better, for an author. But yeah, it's more of an exchange of ideas. And if, especially if one author, like I have a lot of indie friends that have written 20, 30, 40 books, some of them, right? And they're pretty experienced writers. So they have a lot of valuable input and feedback. So they do a review of one of my books. I'm very much keenly aware of how experienced they are and what value they may have. And I'm very listening. I'm all ears, right? So yeah, I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head that it's for authors. That's just how I feel. That doesn't mean that every author feels that way, but what you said is exactly right. I'd love to hear what Carl has to say, but yeah, that's how I feel.
I mean, I don't really write reviews, or certainly I don't make any like YouTube reviews. I guess, you know, I mean, the closest I really consistently come is our little book club where we're reading, we just finished The Prince of Nothing, and now we're reading, you know, the first book in The Aspect Emperor. And I'm very honest about my opinions there. Like I don't hold anything back. I'm very open with criticisms. I think it helps that overall I've really loved the books, and I think our Scott Baker is a phenomenal author. But I'm not afraid to offer criticism. Now I that would be different if it was, yeah, someone who had like 5 reviews on their book, you know, or 5 ratings or whatever. Like I wouldn't do it unless it was 4 or 5 stars, you know, my feelings about it. And I do think, you know, in general, whether you're indie or trad, if you're smaller, you know, reviews can be really meaningful. As opposed to, you know, if you're Brandon Sanderson, like one person's review isn't going to make a difference, you know? Like I was talking about Pierce Brown earlier. The only reason I even like feel comfortable bringing it up is because he's a number one New York Times bestselling author. And I love his series. Like Dark Age is one of my favorite books of all time. But like, I'm not going to be as openly harsh, certainly, with smaller time authors, because I don't want to hurt them. But I do think what Matt, you and PL are saying about, you know, the reviews are for readers. I think there is a lot of value in even 1-2-star reviews for, you know, whether it's my book or someone else's, just because, yeah, it helps you identify, as PL was saying, you know, what is one man's trash is another man's treasure. And I think that makes it really worthwhile. I do think there's a political element, though. Yeah, I mean, just like fundamentally, you know, you want to build relationships. You don't want to alienate anyone. Also, I just try to be a nice person in general. And so, you know, like PL, I don't feel good, you know, going out and just like trashing someone's book. It's just not pleasant. But I mean, again, this is just something I don't think about that often, because I don't write reviews. I wrote one for sort of Kaigen on Goodreads, and I didn't like, you know, I mean, that's a wildly successful book. So I felt, you know, more comfortable being honest. And I liked the book overall. I think I gave it 4 stars. But I had some like genuine criticisms, some of which I hadn't seen people talk about. And so I just wanted to kind of, you know, I don't expect the author, ML Wang, to ever read my review. That's one thing. I mean, just because of the quantity of reviews that she's gotten on that book and the great success she's had, which is well deserved. But it was for me a kind of a way, I guess it was for readers, and it's just kind of for me too, just selfishly, personally, to kind of process my feelings and what worked for me and what didn't work. And, you know, I think as an author, you can grow through that sort of analysis. You know, while I don't really write reviews, one of my favorite things to do is to analyze movies, TV shows, books, comic books, you know, just talking about story structure, talking about, you know, the little details oftentimes, and, you know, character arcs, and just like any aspect of the art and the craft of writing that I think, you know, I can learn from, because I think so often, you know, you can learn as much from other people's work as you can your own, you know, an actual act of writing.
Yeah. Carl, you mentioned this, this concept of like, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. I see that play out a lot with my reviews, because, you know, the one piece of data I can get on what did my review do to the author is Goodreads shows how many people now put this book in their TBR on every day of the year. And if you look back after you put a review out of a book a couple days later, you can see that peak happen.
that coincides with the day that you reviewed the book. And I've noticed, you know, like clockwork, the number one time I see a spike is when I give a 5-star review to a book. And the number two time is a 1-star review.
Wow.
And because I will consistently get people that'll say like, all right, I'm going to put more eyes on this because I'm interested. I don't see it a lot that somebody is outwardly going to hate on a book. Cause I, in my thumbnail of my videos, I say very openly what I thought about the book. I don't want to clickbait you, and people click on those. And constantly the top comments are, Matt hates it, I'm probably going to love it. and it, it, so I don't know, it, it does make me feel a little bit better about that impact where you legitimately are making people like this thing, even though you don't have good things to say about it.
It's sort of that, they, you know, that saying that there's no such thing as bad publicity, which I think is, you know, I think that it's more nuanced than that. Certainly yeah. bad publicity can really hurt someone, someone's career, for example, you know, you see with actors all the time, you know, people get blacklisted in Hollywood, but anyway, side thing. But in general, I think reviews, you know, just like spreading the word about a book, you know, is going to help it, whether that word is good or bad. You know, it's suddenly more people are aware of it. More people are thinking about it. More people have an idea of what it's about, you know? And so, you know, Steve is very open about his love for really dark stories. Right. And so, I know you've never heard it before.
No, never.
But like, you know, I imagine if he sees, someone's reviewer is like, oh, this book is too dark. Like, it's just, it's messed up. I can't stand it. You know, the author must be, you know, a heathen. Like, I just can't deal with it. He grossed me out. And I'm sure Steve's like, oh, I have to read this book, you know, like this is for me. And that's, yeah.
But yeah, you know, Jay Kristoff, who you all probably know, cause I think he's the number one bestseller right now. Yeah. He's kind of helped his career massively by embracing that philosophy. I mean, on every book that he's written, his next book will have these quotes out from the people that hated it the most. and he's poking fun at himself, but also he realizes that concept very clearly, because the things he says are things that me and Steve probably love. I don't know if you like Jay Kristoff books, but the things that he criticizes about himself are things where, you know, I look at that and be like, hell yeah, that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, Joe Abercrombie does that too. He puts up his 1-stars.
I love that.
And obviously Joe Abercrombie is a huge traditionally published fantasy author, and he pokes fun at himself and the people do the 1-stars in terms. Now, maybe I wouldn't do it that way because sometimes he's poking fun at, I mean, essentially the intellect of the people who are writing the 1-stars. But at the same time, I think obviously you have to have a certain amount of confidence in yourself to do that, and confidence in your writing. And frankly, I would argue, I'm not saying that any one of us couldn't, but I would argue that when you are as popular as someone like a Jay Kristoff or a Joe Abercrombie, I think you have a lot more latitude to be able to do that, because really what's it going to affect, right? But at the same time, I think I just want to point out quickly that, you know, when it comes to reviews, let's face facts, right? We as reviewers are fallible human beings. And the systems that we operate in terms of bloggers and writers are certainly not bulletproof. I mean, Goodreads, I mean, come on. My mother could go on and create fake accounts and create 10 million 5-star reviews, right? We all know, we've all heard about the review bombing that's happened on Goodreads and things like that. You know, we know that, you know, I mean, it's not, the system isn't perfect, right? It's not a bad system, but it's not perfect. So I think we also have to put in context that, you know, when we talk about, you know, Matt was the one to say, yeah, you know what, he doesn't consider himself a professional. I do. Like, he approaches it very professionally, right? So do Chris and Varsha and Steve, and I try to, but at the same time, yeah, we're just human beings, right? But our opinion is just that. It's our opinion. It's subjective. And, you know, the most popular booktuber on the planet, I don't know who that is. I don't know how many subs they have in the millions of subs. If they don't like a book, that doesn't mean it's a bad book. And guess what? Maybe they objectively got it wrong. Maybe something with a book, they just, you know what? They had a blind spot on some aspect, and some of the people liked that book. And, you know, I mean, it just happens, right? We're not perfect, and neither are the systems that we operate in.
Yeah, and I think, Steve, you mentioned it early on, but like the place you are mentally when you read a book can change the way you view a book, depending on what the weather was like. I mean, it's, you know, I listen to a lot of audiobooks while I'm driving, and I will review a book unintentionally based on, in part, the performance of the audiobook narrator. How could I not? It's part of the way that I consumed that content. You know, and so, yeah, definitely. I fall for that. I reread books all the time where I could totally change my opinion. I don't think it's because I got smarter. It's just where I was when I read this.
Absolutely true.
Kind of similar to reviews for authors in a way, I guess. For Matt, Varsha, and Chris, how do you handle nasty comments? Do you delete them? Do you respond? What is your kind of mindset, or what is your thought process through negative comments, whether it's mean spirited or constructive criticism? I guess you can say.
I lean into it hard. I'll pin the comment usually. if it's really hateful, and then I'll always respond usually by making fun of myself more than they did. And I found in life that was a really easy way to make people not really make fun of you, is when you were able to kind of poke fun at yourself a little bit and not take life so seriously. But yeah, I lean into it. I have fun with it. I enjoy it. You know, the only times I've ever removed comments is where it felt like inappropriate. Like I try to make my channel, you know, PG-13 at worst. You know, I don't use cuss words. I don't know who's watching my videos. You know, I have kids, they show up on, they randomly click on stuff. You know, I worry about that. And so I'll remove comments if I feel like a child might, I want it to be appropriate, but outside of that, I'd have fun with it.
What about you, Varsha?
Oh, yeah, I haven't had any negative comments because, you know, I'm famous and popular. No, I just don't have enough subscribers and videos I don't get much engagement. So I haven't had to figure out how to deal with this yet.
Varsha, I can solve this for you. Go, go like one-star review a Brandon Sanderson book. and you, problem solved.
Even better.
Excellent.
Get Talk One Piece. I guarantee you will be mobbed overnight. Yeah. They will find your personal Facebook. The One Piece fans will come for you.
You're right. Or Shit Talk Malazan. Mobbed. It's like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I recently trashed on a Conan the Barbarian book, like the first one, and because I don't read books with a historical lens, I read them with a modern lens. I'm not smart enough to be able to tell you what people thought back when they were written. So I usually trash on old books because you kind of got to read them with the right mindset, and I don't have that mindset. And I was like, I searched myself on like Twitter, and there were like thousands of people like, this guy is the worst. Like, this guy needs to not be a thing anymore. And so, like, there's some. It's funny, like, what's a big fandom? I never would have thought, like, Conan the Barbarian was like this aggressively hardcore fandom, but here we are.
Oh, yeah. Because books that were, I mean, and I love, I won't lie, I mean, probably because I'm old, I love books, and yeah, probably because of what I took in school. I love books written from a certain era. I love books that are older. I love the classical fantasy stuff. But I think Matt raised a really interesting point about fandom. Like, I think it's sad that we live in an era where, you know, we can't engage in discourse and agree to disagree in all of cases, then that's fine. We still love you, man. We hug afterwards and kumbaya, but we just disagree. You like this book, I don't like it, it's fine, and we move on. I wish there was a lot more of that in what I see today in terms of discourse about books and everything else in general. Everything's just so polarized. Like, you can't, like, if you don't like something, some people feel that you're a bad person, or if you like something, then you're, I just wish there was less of that. And And I mean, that's what we're here. Like, we watch all of our favorite booktubers, not because they say the same things about the same books, but because we're actually hoping to hear something different or an insight that we haven't seen, or, you know, like Carl was saying, like we're not looking just to have echo chambers, right? You know, and but it's sad that there's a bit, there seems to be you know, less and less of that.
I think it takes intention, I think, not to do that, is part of it. And I think people in general need to take more attention with the things they say, and, you know, not necessarily say everything they're thinking and process information. And, there's a lot of book series that are pretty big, but not huge, that I love. And especially on those, you know, I internally take exception when somebody doesn't like them, because I'm like, man, this should be like the biggest thing. Like when I hear somebody talk something negatively about like The Sun Eater or something by like Christopher Rocchio, who's a decently big author. I think it's his career. But I feel like he should be, you know, at the mega height of book writing. And so when I hear somebody say negatively internally, I'm like, man, screw that guy. And then I'm like, actually, they're probably got a good point, and they're just a person with thoughts. it's hard.
But it is interesting, because it's something I think about quite a lot when I read people's comments. I think there's a perception from people that they think YouTubers are professional. You know, they treat them like traditional media, like somebody has sat down, and whether for truth or not, like in the case of yourself, Matt, they're sitting down watching your review going that you are proclaiming that you do know what you're talking about, rather than the viewpoint that you actually are taking, which is I'm just talking about my feelings about a book. But they sort of have it, because of the way viewing habits have changed for a lot of people over the past number of years, that all of a sudden the amount of content, the type of content, the viewpoints of the content are all in an entitlement, like it would be if it was traditional. Like the amount of people and friends that I've had that don't make content for a while, and there's just this nearly a stream in their page of, where did you go? Why are you not making content anymore? I need more content, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I think about that even more and more as the people are leaving platforms and all the rest of it, of the outside pressures and the expectations that people have on what is essentially everybody's hobby. What they're doing, you know?
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways it's not necessarily the people's fault, because, you know, we've, a lot of people that are on the internet have grown up in a time where things like Twitch have blown up, and there are people that have made obscene amount of millions on content creation. And there's this perception that if you make content and people are watching it, you're probably making, you know, you're probably upper class, let alone making money. And so they just have this automatic assumption that you're a professional. You should know, you should have more due diligence on things. And when they don't realize that this is like the eighth most popular, most important thing in my life. You know, it's not like a...
Like we live in a society where the number one, if you go to school, kids, the number one occupation they all want is to be a YouTuber. Like that is essentially what the number one desirable thing is. Again, from an uneducated view, in terms of people don't actually realize how much work that is. I mean, the amount of monetary return from the amount of hours that you put in and get out is not a great career in a lot of ways for that reason. So I think the whole media thing, viewpoint that we have is skewed at the moment anyway. And I think it'll take a while to kind of redress and put itself together. But it's sort of like you have made yourself a public figure because you put a YouTube video up about a book review of Dungeon Crawler Carl, and all of a sudden you're all of a sudden you're just you're to be taking pot shots at.
Yeah, I mean, I coach a lot of youth sports for my kids. So I coach soccer and baseball and softball and all that stuff. And when I introducing myself to like a new team of like 5-year-olds and 7-year-olds, I'll give them a little background on me, and I'm a chief of staff for like a politician, and they're like, oh, whatever. And like I have a YouTube channel, and they're like, what? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah. But it's funny. I the other day I was looking at my list in YouTube, which YouTubers I watch. You know, we all subscribe to probably, you know, dozens and dozens of channels, but The ones there's no YouTuber that I watch that has much more than 100K subs, and most of them have nowhere near that. I think the biggest I probably watch regularly is probably Mike's Books Reviews. But I mean, there's obviously, or maybe Daniel Green. I don't know how many he has subs Daniel Green has, but he's probably, yeah. So, but most of the booktubers I watch have, you know, somewhere between 5 or less thousand subscribers. And those are my go-tos, right? And it's, I guess for me, it's much more my trust in them, my belief in them. If I know them personally, what kind of relationship I have with them, but I don't, I'm not trying to make myself sound special, but I'm not looking for the pop, uber popular, you know, tubers. I'm looking more for a booktuber whose opinion I trust, who seems credible, like, you know, someone like Matt, who's got a lot of integrity, someone like Steve, who will, you know, always, you know, or Chris or Varsha, who will always be, they'll be honest, right? And they'll do a good job at, you know, kind of giving you that Cole's notes. This is why I like it. This is why I don't. You know what I mean? Chris is very analytical, and I really enjoy that. You know, and yeah, but there's, like, I'm not looking for, well, I'm not punching in, you know, booktuber, find the one with the most subscribers at Thousand Fantasy, and that's what I'm going to watch, right? So
I think,
yeah. Go ahead, Carl.
I was just going to say, I think it's worth noting, too, that even for, you know, quote unquote, professional reviewers going back now, I mean, you can go back hundreds of years, really, they're not all like the most either analytical or the most like classy, I guess is the word you could say. Like, people started feuds. People would get personal. People still do this, maybe more than they ever have before. You know, like major newspapers would publish reviews that just like tear authors or playwrights or whoever apart, and not just their work, but them as people, you know? So what we're seeing is not so much like the whole idea of reviews has fundamentally changed, I feel like, so much as it is there just are so many more now, and social media amplifies, you know, the angriest voices a lot of the time. It's just how the algorithms work. And I mean, cause it gets engagement. And you know, you get these Twitter mobs and things, or X mobs, excuse me. And it's just a matter of, you know, just the sheer volume, I guess, and not so much. I think I would say that there is a lot of good to be said about, you know, booktuber. I mean, that's why we all watch them, right? Like, you know, credit to all of you, right? And that, you know, the idea of it being professional or not, you know, I think there's the same potentials for pros and cons in terms of someone being, you know, a dickhead, even professionally, because people make careers out of it. There's one specific movie reviewer who I will not name, but who is very successful. I could name him because he's very successful, but who is just the most negative, just like rude person you will see. His reviews are just like, it hurts my soul reading his reviews, because he's just so unkind and will attack the filmmakers personally. But he's, you know, published in like major publications, and you know, I think you can find these people anywhere. And again, going back hundreds of years, shit used to be political. Like, people would literally form like little, I mean, the elites, right, who would like read these things and actually cared. You know, the common everyday person doesn't give a shit about reviews, which I would say is still true. You know, the vast majority of people who read a book aren't all that concerned with the reviews around it.
Yeah, I mean, to this point of like big reviewers not necessarily knowing what they're talking about or being trustworthy, I will very openly say that, you know, if I was to make like a top 10 list of my favorite booktubers, and I won't for the same reason PL won't do the same thing for authors, I at least half of them would be people with like under 1,000 subs on the people that I would go, because something changes about people as they get bigger. I won't necessarily say exactly why. I think part of it is that algorithm unintentionally influencing you. But like, if I was watching videos, like, I would never watch my own stuff. Like, I would only watch people that like singularly, I really will never watch a review for somebody that has over like 5,000 subs. I start to not trust that they're giving me their honest opinion. And that's not what I'm looking for. I just want some dude to press on and tell me what they thought without worrying about it.
I don't know, Mal, I'd recommend you to yourself, Melita. I think it's pretty good.
But I mean, it's hard to trust. I trust myself because I am myself, but it's hard to trust that people are telling you the truth. And yeah. The bigger you are, the more the chances of that being untrustworthy are. You know, the chances of somebody with 10 subs telling me their thoughts on a book being untrustworthy is 0%.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. That's the point. So I guess I'm trustworthy.
Yeah, well, I was looking at Goodreads there. See, between everybody here in the call that's listed their score for your Drowned Kingdom, PL, you've rated it the harshest out of everybody, so...
Well, I think that's, you know, first of all, even just rating your own book in a lot of ways is disingenuous. Yeah. But, and I've done it, so I'm not trying to be hypocritical here. I'm just saying that I've done it, same. But I didn't get my... But I didn't give myself a 5-star until I wrote a certain book because I didn't believe, honestly, it was a 5-star. But when that's I cool. thought it was worth a 5-star, I gave myself a bloody 5-star. So I don't know if that's some weird back-end kind of integrity or not, but that's just how I felt. I felt I wrote my best book with that book. I gave a 5-star, and, you know, I went for there. But, you know, as Matt said, reviews are for readers, man. So, you know... If someone gives my book a 1-star, they're entitled to do that, right? And I can't, I will never, ever. Now, you want to talk about something I hate is we've all seen a lot of battles on social media when it comes to reviewers, authors. We don't need to go into the specifics of those, but you know, some of them are pretty horrible. You know, but my view as an author and a reviewer and a book tour blogger is that if I get a negative review, I still like the review because someone took the time to review my book. You know, if they're a troll, and I don't know they're a troll, I, you don't always know. Sometimes you do, but I will like it on Goodreads or Amazon or whatever. And that's it. I won't comment, right? You know, I'll just like the fact that, hey, thanks for giving me a review. And that's it. And obviously, if the review is very endorsing, you know, I will say, thank you so much. I'm so honored you love the book. And, you know, thank you so much for taking time to read it and rate it so highly, blah, blah, blah. But that's it. I would never, you know, attack someone who, you know, didn't give me a positive review. That's totally offline, right? I would be ashamed of myself if I did something like that. And I think it's inappropriate. And I think that if you know it's a review that's done even with malintent, even just because the person didn't like you, okay, there's remedies for that, right? If you think it's a spiteful review, there's remedies through. I know that these Amazon and Goodreads are not perfect either, and dealing with them can be tough. But there's remedies for that. But don't take that public, right? Try and fix it. If you think it's actually, you know, like a review bomb, it's fake or whatever, do it. Deal with the platform through that and just move on, right? Don't attack the person, especially if you know you believe, okay, you know what? The person generally didn't like my book and they're really trashing it. Well, that's they're entitled to do that, right? Like, that's their prerogative. So you have to stay far away from that, right? Like don't rise to, you know, just move on. It may hurt, so suck it up and take it privately and move on. Commiserate with your friends, your mom, or your dog, or your spouse, but move on.
Or join the Marmite Authors Book Club. Sure.
yeah, that's been great. Yeah, we're gonna have a live in April with the Marmites, and it's a bunch of great people. A lot of them, you know, probably for sure, like a lot of them are on Page Chewing on these forums. So you're gonna see people like Holly Tinsley probably show up, Tim Hardy, Jacob Sanix, you know, myself. So yeah, it's been a really supportive, amazing group that we've gotten each other through a lot of highlights and lowlights, and we still are, because, you know, our careers are hopefully they're at the ground level, not the ascent. Yeah. So, you know, but yeah, it's a great amazing, it's been wonderful to be part of that. So
cool. And I just noticed we are coming up on 2 hours, and Matt, I know, ooh, you want to spend time with your kids, so to wrap up. I want to say thanks again, Matt, and everybody who was able to show up. Really appreciate everyone's time. To wrap up, I'd like to hear everyone tell us how long they spend on content each week on average. And Carl, you're kind of a content creator now.
Making it or?
Participating in, making it, okay. Editing, whatever, part of the process.
That is a good
question. Are we counting like writing too? Because that completely changes.
Could be. Well, I guess, how much time do you spend writing and how much time do you spend assisting in content?
Well, for me personally, I don't even want to go into the writing. It's stupid amounts of time. Particularly for how much money I make, it's pursuing a career as a writer is, anyway, but in terms of like assisting, I don't know, how long are our little book clubs? It's like a couple hours,
2 hours per week.
So probably 2 hours on average, 2 to 4 any given week, I feel like.
That's about right. What about you, PL?
I can't put a number to it. I mean, I'm just leaving writing out of it. I'm sticking strictly of now I'm getting into YouTube and getting the channel off the ground. Just writing a review or putting a review to YouTube or, promoting it on social media, trying to draw attention to the book and et cetera. So then you're putting it on various social media platforms. You're engaging with people. Like, okay, if someone makes a comment on your channel, as you guys all know, you want to engage and say thank you so much for commenting and engage the comment. Like, it's
or pin it.
It's untold hours. Like, I don't think you can, like, quantitatively, I can't even describe how many hours it's. You know, it's a lot. So, it's a lot.
What about you, Matt? How many hours a week would you say you spend on content on average?
Well, I have to read books to make the content.
Yeah.
But I would read them anyways. But I spend probably 25 or so hours a week reading. A few hours a day, at least. I don't really watch TV. So that's what I do. And I would be otherwise doing something like that. And then on my videos, probably maybe an hour a week.
Wow. Nice. It helps when you have a smooth delivery like you, Matt, because you can just flow and then it's minimal editing. I think you learn that pretty quick to have a first or have a nice take so you don't have to clean it up after the fact.
Yeah. I also want to do this. I don't want to get burnt out. And I know that would be the reason I would get burnt out, is if that one number turned into like 3 or 4.
I just want to speak to that really quickly to say that absolutely, I ran a podcast about like analyzing films and screenwriting for a while, and it burned me out. It was just like one more thing on top of everything. You know, I spent who knows how many hours a week editing podcast episodes, you know, recording them, trying to book guests, things like that. It was just so exhausting. I think that's very shrewd, honestly, the way you're handling it, Matt.
And Varsha, what about you? How long on average would you say?
I guess for group discussions, it could be, I think we have at least 3.5 hours of a recurring basis of discussions. Yeah. So that's 3.5 hours. And then if I have something on the weekends, then I don't know, like each discussion goes to about 1.5 hours. So between 3.5 to 6 hours, just the discussion. And then I guess the post-processing, since I don't do any editing, Chris, it takes about 1 hour. Not 1 hour, just like, yeah, most of it is just waiting for the exports to happen or the uploads to happen. So the actual thing, and making thumbnails that I do not enjoy very much, but yeah. But Chris loves making thumbnails. I'd say about 6 to 8 hours, I think. But this is for when I'm doing discussions and I love all of it. Like, it's a really enjoyable aspect of the content creation. When I make solo videos, I think it could take me anywhere between 2.5 to 3 hours per solo video to 5 hours sometimes. And that I don't enjoy the editing process afterwards. But yeah, lately I've been doing largely just discussions. So,
what about you, Chris?
Well, my number depends on the two people to the left and right of me on the screen here very much, because they dictate exactly what I'm going to be doing on a week-to-week basis and how much I'm going to be doing. But let's say I'm a bit the same as you, Varsha, but three streams a week between ours. And to be fair, because I'm not involved in doing anything other than turning up and kind of giving my thoughts for those, that's, it's not like other content creation in a lot of ways. It is just kind of it's more like meeting up with your friends and having a chat. If I was to make my own video, which I haven't been recently, but it would be around 3 to 4 hours per video, I would say. Mainly because I do like the editing process. I hate the recording part. If somebody could like Severance, you know, just take me out of my body, do the recording bit, give me a whole load of unedited footage. I'll spend the 3 or 4 hours editing and then some, because that is an enjoyable kind of chill out experience for me. That is something that, it's one of the reasons that I like doing it, is because I can kind of lose time and de-stress by doing that. It's not something that I'm nearly actively engaged in. And as you say, I do love making thumbnails. It's the best part of the whole process. Just make thumbnails for videos I'm never going to make. It's fun in its own right, you know.
That's insane.
I don't know. I just do everybody's thumbnails all the time. Just, but they would all sort of have a similar theme and an idea in them. But that's it. So, but that's also why I haven't been making my own videos recently, is because, you know, the actual recording process of it, I couldn't care less. Hate it.
We have the opposite, like, so if we could just become one content creator. I like recording. I hate playing back and listening to myself talk. I think that's a big part of why I hate editing, but
I'm great, because apparently I'm the only person who can really understand my own accent and diction easily, so maybe that's why I don't mind.
I think on average, I was trying to figure, I think between planning and participating and editing and creating show notes and stuff, maybe 10 to 12 hours a week total, bits and pieces. So yeah, it can get pretty... Mm-hmm. Pretty time intensive sometimes, but.
But sometimes it is hard to know when it's too much. Like, I have definitely fallen foul of that a lot of times. I've kind of agreeing to do too much because I enjoy it so much, like loving it so much and loving the interaction and the mental invigoration that a lot of that gives you. And then coming to a point where going, why am I so tired? And actually realizing you're doing it to yourself because of your, it seems like too much of anything. Like, I like a little drink of rum now and again, but if I drank rum all day, every night, you know, at a certain point in the morning, why I'm not functioning during the day, I mightn't realize it's the rum straight away, but at a certain point, the rum's making me pay a price for it, you know?
On that note, I'll be sure and put everyone's contact information down in the show notes. Be sure and check everyone out. And Matt, thank you again for making time out of your busy schedule. Really appreciate it. And sorry for the confusion. I think we planned it pre-daylight savings time, and I think that my lizard brain can't keep up. So
no worries. It was all good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again, everyone, and we'll talk very soon. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.